Hi, Mike Friedman. Welcome to KBOO for a continuation of our discussion of the COVID pandemic.
Hi, Bill. Thank you, and it's nice to talk to you again.
Mike Friedman is an evolutionary biologist, studies the microbiome, teaches and writes in biology department in the University of Antigua and Barbuda. For the last year, and especially since the development of the COVID-19 virus, he's been following it very carefully. COVID-19, of course, is a respiratory disease. It's been detected in over 4 million people now in the United States, killed close to 150,000. Mike, a lot has happened in the last 7 months since the first cases were discovered in China. We know considerably more about the virus, though to be sure many important things remain in doubt. Today we'll draw on what we know, how to successfully deal with it, and protect human life, and also maintain sufficient production of necessary goods to live a good life. Now, to be sure, Trump and his administration have botched it completely up to now, now running wild across the United States. Still, even today, things could be done. It would be an enormous task. Second, today we'll talk about what's needed to prepare for what seems a certainty that at some point the virus gets transmitted from animals to humans, that is both highly contagious, much more than COVID-19, and also highly lethal. COVID-19 is dangerous. Some viruses have proven to be highly lethal. No virus recently in the last several hundred years has proved to be both highly lethal and highly contagious, but it surely could come. In fact, it's very likely to come if we continue the way we're operating today, in terms of the economic development and the penetration of every ecosystem on Earth to make it profitable for human beings. Mike, tell us about that Herculean effort, but what would be necessary to stop COVID-19 in this country? What are the lessons we've learned?
Well, the main lesson is that you have to start early and you have to conduct adequate testing from early on in order to be able to survey community transmission and to be able to trace contact and then quarantine people. And you also have to implement adequate social distancing, personal protection, and stay in place or lockdown type situations. But all of this needs to be done early before cases spread out and transmission is widespread. And of course, this is complicated by the fact that there is transmission of coronavirus from asymptomatic cases. That's the big thing that I think we've learned. The other thing that we've learned from all of these cities that are reopening and countries that didn't take the appropriate measures like Sweden is that you can't reopen precipitously. You can't reopen without adequate controls in place. Even California, I was going to say Florida, in which basically the state government ignored precautions and basically followed the line of Donald Trump. But even in California, you had a situation where opening was precipitous. Because of the national mixed messaging, a lot of people did not abide by proper social distancing and protection, you know, masks. And now California, of course, is increasing. In this country, almost 99% of the decisions that are made regarding public health are going to be made with at least an eye to corporations and making money and profits. Those are going to be in the back of policymakers' minds or in the front of their minds. That meant that a lot of places in the U.S. threw caution to the wind, and then they just reopened their economies. And so in some cases, they never shut down, like, for example, meatpacking plants.
So it's gotten out of control in the U.S., nearly everywhere, but it is not running wild now, apparently, in New York City.
It's not yet
running wild again, because
right,
it is opening up. In New York, there was a day, apparently, very recently, where there were no deaths in New York versus the thousands of deaths not 2 months ago per day. That indicates a lockdown really can be effective. as long as it's continued and as long as you don't have people migrating into the city from places where COVID is running wild and where you're getting a lot of asymptomatic people coming in and infecting those New Yorkers.
Yeah, but there's no wall around New York.
Yeah, that's a big problem in the United States. People move a lot. We're number one in the world on the use of energy per capita, and a lot of it is gasoline and moving around. Go deeper into the problems of what isolation and lockdown would mean.
Okay. Two of the big problems are, first, the size of the country and its diversity. It's demographic diversity and its geographic diversity and its urban-rural diversity. Because of the size of the country, that immediately creates a problem with trying to maintain any kind of tracing and testing and isolation and so on. And then the second problem, as you mentioned, is the socioeconomic disparities in the U.S., which put limits on people's ability to respond to the stay-at-home orders, for example, or to obtain testing. Basically, if you impose shelter in place on a population that doesn't have decent access to supermarkets or doesn't have decent access to housing or is jailed or any number of similar conditions.
Doesn't have income to order in food from your local restaurant.
Can't use Seamless or Grubhub or those, right? Yeah, these are two of the major difficulties in organizing a response in this country, which are historic and structural or physical. So taking that into account, you would have to have a coordinated response. That's number one. You need coordination from the federal down through the states. Number two, you would have to have in place the social support network that would allow you to support people who are in lockdown in, you know, Native American reservations or in impoverished communities in the cities. You would also have to have adequate legislation in place so that essential workers are protected and they have sick leave and they have sick pay and so on and so forth. Then you would also have to have in place something which was basically decimated by years of neoliberal cutbacks, an adequate public health system. I think the figure is 56,000 public health workers were laid off in the past decade or so. This public health network is essential for surveillance, for screening, for getting out PPE. We saw some of what public health does during the HIV period, where people would do testing and they would work in health education, for example, in the gay community. So these are some of the things that need to be in place. With those in place, you can carry out the type of testing you need to survey communities, look for hotspots, trace contacts, monitor people coming into the country or moving around. And that has a bad ring to it, given our context, but those are the types of things that are needed. With those measures in place, you could implement selective containment measures. So in some cases, people can go out if adequate measures are taken. So a lockdown doesn't necessarily have to be 100%, although if we're going to do it right, it might require a reset where we are implementing a full lockdown. And then as people study how the disease is transmitted in certain areas and certain populations, you can begin to ease up.
Mike, one thing that's favorable, it seems to me, in being able to maintain a lockdown for a while and get people essential services and get food to people, and it would have to be to everybody, is that COVID-19 is contagious primarily, in my understanding, through aerosols or through droplets in the air.
As you said, coronavirus is transmitted through droplets and aerosols. It's a respiratory infection. In this, it differs from a number of other diseases that we've seen epidemics in recent years, like Ebola, which is body fluids, or norovirus, which is foods, and so on. A respiratory tract disease is more highly transmissible than these other forms. One of the problems we've had is that until recently, the WHO refused to concede that it was transmitted by aerosol. They thought it was just transmitted by larger droplets. So the larger droplets mean that they would fall from the air quickly, and maybe your social distancing of 6 feet was an adequate response. And by the way, that six-foot rule is kind of antiquated. This came from the 40s or earlier. But when you have aerosol transmission, the virus can spread out much further than 6 feet. Transmission has implications for the types of measures you would take, so that you would want, for example, adequate ventilation in facilities where you're going to have people moving around or congregating, like factories, that the six-foot rule is kind of a vague and maybe not so great rule of thumb. Social distancing means being prudent.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Mike Friedman, a microbiologist. Especially since the outbreak of COVID, he's been studying viruses and virus transmission and the way, in fact, viruses can be dealt with. We've been discussing that in terms of what could be done now in the United States. Even now, it would be a huge effort, a huge project, requiring maybe more cooperation and public acceptance than can be gained in this country. Do you think it's conceivable we have to, in fact, stop the pursuit of profits for 2 months, maybe not 1 month, which is what New York succeeded in, a month and a half, although they have a lot of in-migration into New York? Would that be possible? Or do you think that the forces of profit overall would prevail in the Democratic Party?
I don't place much hope in a Democratic administration taking the type of deep-rooted measures that would have to be taken to fully deal with this pandemic. They have the capability to do it, as we saw earlier this year. But all the while, you have these corporations champing at the bit to put the economy back into motion. And so these corporations, this is not a question of choice, it's a question of necessity, because the usual dynamic is always going to be in place, where if you're not making profits, if you're not able to compete with your corporations and you're not raking in profits, then you risk going out of business. Plus the fact that the Democratic Party is committed to the same neoliberal policies they were before. I mean, there are social modifications. So yes, I think a Biden administration might take some palliative measures, but is it going to be willing to shut down when it needs to shut down? Is it going to be willing to legislate for unions, for workers to have full paid benefits, full paid leave? Is it going to be willing to legislate for single payer, which basically Biden has rejected? So I don't think it's capable of taking the types of measures that need to be taken. But there's always the caveat that if working people can get together, and if the unions can become belligerent and aggressive in making demands around these things, then they'll win concessions. The bottom line here, as with climate change or anything else, is class struggle can make a difference. In the case of a pandemic like this, it can make a big difference, because if you can force the government to take some of these actions, then you can contain the virus until the RO drops low enough and basically it, for all intents and purposes, vanishes like it did in a small country like New Zealand. I mean, there are all kinds of ifs involved here. A lot of the politicians seem to think that they can hang on until this becomes a new normal, a miserable normal for most people, or they can hang on until we develop herd immunity. These are all wrinkles which can affect the outcome.
This is Cable Radio, Bill Resnick for the Old Mole, talking to Mike Friedman, a microbiologist who's been studying COVID-19 and other viruses and studying the research. Mike, COVID-19 is a virus that's highly contagious, and it's very dangerous but it's not close to 100% lethal like some viruses where the contagion could be contained. It's more contagious, you've discussed, than the flu, and it's more dangerous than the flu. It seems a certainty to me, though, and I think to microbiologists, that the mother of all viruses, a virus is bound to, at some time in the future, be transmitted from animals to humans that is both highly contagious in many ways, touching aerosols, every other way that it could be contagious and be passed from human to human. It's very contagious and very lethal, like Ebola, for example. There's no genetic reason that those mutations in time would not develop. So what would be necessary in terms of building a public health system, or is it even possible? What kind of public health system do we need that could make a response to that virus of all viruses?
Ed Young wrote an article in The Atlantic earlier this month called America Should Prepare for a Double Pandemic. According to Young, there are about 40,000 known viruses in other mammals, about a quarter of which could be transmitted to human beings. So that's a lot of viruses we can obtain from livestock, from animals we increasingly come into contact with in the wild as we reduce their habitats. People have been predicting this for years, that there was going to be a pandemic because there has been surveillance. People know that there are constantly cases of transmission on pig farms, for example, different types of virus, a lot of different types of flu. Fortunately for us, they haven't mutated to the degree where they can be transmitted between people. So they'll be transmitted from pigs, you'll get sick, and then you recover from it or not. We talked about the measures that would have to be taken to forestall these pandemics the last time we spoke. What kind of broad international and national response would we need, and what kind of institutions would we have to have in place? Well, for one thing, on a broad scale, you would have to have functional institutions at an international level that are coordinating public health efforts. We have the WHO right now, which has shown its own limitations and is also being panned by Donald Trump. That has the potential effect of preventing the WHO from working adequately, but it also creates doubt in terms of the WHO. So if the U.S. withdraws, other countries, allies are withdrawn, basically the thing falls apart. So you need international institutions that can coordinate surveillance. You need international institutions that have some bite, that can deal with international trade, international legality, immigration, and so tourism, and so on and so forth. And I'm not advocating, by the way, for banning tourism or banning immigration, but I'm saying that we need institutions that can monitor and account for these. At a national level, we need basically the same things I outlined before. You need an adequate public health system. You need to invest in clinical medicine as well, because we saw what's been happening. Doctors are probably at the point of breakdown right now. Doctors, nurses, other health workers are burning out. If we get hit with another pandemic at this point, that will be the straw that breaks the camel's back. Hospital, bed space, equipment have all been diverted into the COVID-19 crisis. And if there's another pandemic, it's going to pile on top of that. Plus, if it's another, as is likely, respiratory pandemic, the effects will be partially masked by similar symptoms in coronavirus patients.
You know, one final thing, Mike. What you would need is a vast amount of public cooperation. You would need a public that was not suspicious of anything that government does, who recognizes we're all in this together, who are ready to make sacrifices for other people and understand that, who are ready to cooperate in great national endeavors, even if they're at the expense of themselves, who are ready, in fact, to pay taxes because they know they're necessary. It seems to me the U.S. and U.S. capitalism, the fish rots from the top, we really have to return to a sense of community and cooperation and social justice for everybody, people of color, of course, and the white working class. It seems to me we really have to create a different country very quickly that really is characterized by that cooperation and willing to sacrifice, or at least this country could be finished.
Yeah, I mean, we have to break with the Thatcher-Reaganite idea that there is no such thing as society. And basically that means that we have to overturn 40-plus years of neoliberal policies and the ethos that accompanied those policies. Everything that's done here atomizes people into individuals that have no real connection to each other. The only connection that's forged is the one that comes from below, and we've seen that happening. But we have to overturn that type of mentality. As you say, the fish rots from the top, so what we also have to do is have a system in which there is coherent and human need-guided policymaking from the top down through all of the different levels of society.
Yeah, well, it also has to bubble up from the anarchist position when they say we are all leaders. People have to have the sense that they are treating justly, they are not just listened to, but are part of the decisional process and are prepared to, in fact, think about those things and not, you know, entertain themselves rather than actually being social participants. Mike Friedman, thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Thank you for the invitation. I appreciate that.
Thanks, Mike.